You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, you're human again.
Okay, good.
I bumped the mic and you turned into like a chipmunk robot.
Oh, fun.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host from Portland, Oregon, Richard Wally.
And from California, we've got Cassidy Robinson.
Did you do anything fun? Christmas parties, anything like that?
Well, we went and saw Krampus again. Friends wanted to see it, so we did that. What else did we do? Oh, we started watching The Walking Dead because we had it recorded.
Mm-hmm.
With also the same friends, so we spent a lot of time with them this weekend.
Right.
He's also one that I've been kind of like, well, he's doing it a lot more than I am. Good for him for being like all proactive and all that, but he's been building like board and card games and stuff like that. So it was interesting. We demoed a game that he's been building, and it actually was working pretty well. I was pretty like, oh, well, hell, okay.
What was the concept of his game? Or do you not want to say it in case it's not TM'd yet?
I don't know. Maybe I just shouldn't. I didn't think about that. I was going to, but maybe I shouldn't. Now I'm worried.
Well, you haven't said anything too specific yet, so I think we're still okay.
No, it's like a strategy card game.
Okay. So did he make all the cards himself?
Yeah, I mean, he used stock photos, and there's actually places you can get like deck cards, like a 52 deck.
Mm-hmm.
For pretty cheap with whatever picture you want on them. Actually, what's funny is the decks are like 12, but then the shipping and handling is like 15 or something like that. So it's like you have to buy in bulk. But
yeah, that's how a lot of that kind of stuff works, especially like with like anything that has to do with like, because I've looked into like making business cards for the podcast in case I go public places where I would be handy right. to pass them out. And like, it's always like, it would be cheaper to buy 1,000 than it would to buy like 100.
Yeah, it's normally like that with weird little things like that.
Yeah.
So no, but it was pretty, the concept was pretty good. It was working. It was mechanically functional, which is usually the biggest struggle with games.
So. Right. We, me and my friends, we've been to a lot of cons lately. I think it was when we went to, I want to say it was the Long Beach Comic Con, like back in the early summer.
Mm-hmm.
We found a big booth of these people who had invented a game, and they were selling like, you know, boxes of it. Like they hadn't, I guess, like it looked legit. Like you could sell it and everything. It wasn't like they were like, you know, cut and pasted together. Like they were like copied and in boxes with like plastic wrap and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like a, you know, a creator-owned game or whatever, and they were there, and they were kind of showing us how to play it. The name of the game is Super Fight. Have you ever heard
okay.
of this? Or seen a booth or anything?
I haven't. No, I've seen it. I think I've seen it, though, in stores, but I haven't.
Right.
I don't know much about it.
It's a kind of a variation on the Cards Against Humanity kind of party game,
mm-hmm.
except for instead of, like, basically the... You draw X amount of cards, everybody in the group draws X amount of cards, and then, like, you and the person to the left of you, like, you put down random cards based upon, like, a white deck and a black deck, and you'll randomly create, like, a thing. Like, it could be, like, you know, one card that you put down will be, I don't know, Margaret Thatcher, and then the other card that you draw randomly will be... in a jet plane.
Okay.
And then the other person will be like Barney the dinosaur with a nuclear missile or something like that. And then you have to debate point counterpoint style.
Okay.
Why your thing would beat the other thing.
I have not played or seen it, but somebody, not you, actually, I think it was one of somebody we had a guest week, Mindy Crouchley, a couple weeks ago. I think somebody within that group told me about this game.
It's a lot of fun, but
it's this versus this kind of, yeah.
Right. No. Yeah. And then the rest of the group acts as a judge to decide who won the debate. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun, but we found that we had to add a lot of house rules mm-hmm. because there wasn't enough parameters. It's like, okay, so if you're Mario, does that mean that you're Mario with all of the Mario powers, or have you not like caught the flower yet? Or like,
well, yeah, it seems like you'd have to define your,
Like that almost,
in academic terms, you have to define your terms and stuff like that.
But. Exactly. And then we decided we also needed a time limit per argument because there was no such rule. So we timed it so that it was 2 minutes per argument, or else it could just go on all night.
Hmm.
But then there's like expansion packs, like locations or whatever. So you could end up being like Aquaman or whatever, and then draw from one of the expansions and end up in a desert.
Okay.
So it's fun. I don't know. I don't know why I'm shilling for these guys, but
no. It's the indie game board kind of thing right now is very big, and there's a lot of good stuff out there.
Mm. So in case nobody's listened to this podcast before, we're nerds.
We do some nerdy stuff here and there. Yeah. Once in a while.
This is a safe place.
Sometimes.
Right.
We may judge you. Okay. We won't troll you, but we will judge you nicely.
Let's get into the movie news. Right off the top, I'm just going to go over the Golden Globe nominations. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time reading these, and I'll skip a lot of the categories, especially the TV stuff. But the only reason I'm bringing this up at all, because, you know, basically the Golden Globes, nobody cares.
Right.
Even the people nominated, they rarely care. But the only reason I'm interested in it this year, and why I actually made a point of looking at it, is because I have no the fuck idea what we're supposed to be rooting for this year. It seems like 1,000 movies came out in the last 4 weeks. They're all about the same level of budget and star power and director buzz and they're all supposed to be competing, I guess, but I just there's nothing I'm looking at that I'm like, oh, that's clearly going to be the best picture of the year or like one of the main contenders. Like I can think of like, oh yeah, there's a good little acting performance there. There's a da 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 there. So this was
already picked mine.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have our individual lists, but which is usually not all that similar to the best pictures, but I'll just go over this. Motion picture drama. Now remember, the Golden Globes does a goofy thing where they have the drama category and the musical comedy category. Mm-hmm. So the actual Oscars may take a little from both. But motion picture drama is Carol, which I reviewed a little while ago, Mad Max Fury Road, The Revenant, Room, and Spotlight.
Okay.
So that, other than Mad Max, that kind of makes sense. I felt like Room, I loved Room. I thought it was a great movie and I totally recommend it. But it's such a small movie that I'm surprised. Like I knew for sure that Brie Larson would be nominated for Best Actress, but I thought like the movie itself would be kind of overlooked because it's so intimate.
Every once in a while they're like, oh, look at this little one. Mm-hmm. And like, you mean you don't know why they picked that one? It was a good one, but of all the like little movies that are pretty good that came out that year, it was like, oh, okay, sure.
Yeah. Okay. Actress in a motion picture, Kate Blanchett for Carol, Brie Larson for Room, Rooney Mara for Carol, so they'll be up against each other, Saoirse Ronan for Brooklyn, and Alicia Vikander for The Danish Girl. Which didn't get as much love as everyone thought it would this year. Or at least yet. Maybe it will in the bigger Guild Awards and the Oscars, but probably not. Best Actor in a Drama? Hold on. Best Actor in a Drama, Christian Bale in Big Short, Steve Carell in Big Short, Matt Damon in The Martian,
I thought you were going to say Big Short again.
I mean, I could. They're all nominated. Al Pacino and Danny Collins. I don't even know what that movie is. And Mark Ruffalo and Infinite Polar Bear. TV, skipping it. TV. Where's the musical?
I don't know. This year I might be more interested in the TV, but go on.
Oh, okay.
Don't the Golden Globes, don't they matter for TV a little bit more though?
I think it is a little bit. I mean, the Emmys are really what you want to win if you're a TV show.
Okay.
But the Golden Globes is kind of like you know, it's nice.
It's like a runner-up award, sure. Okay, I think I get it.
Yeah. Okay, so motion picture comedy, which I accidentally skipped, was a comedy musical. Is Big Short, Joy, which I haven't seen it, but I guess it's a comedy, The Martian, that's debatable, Spy, and Trainwreck.
Trainwreck?
Yeah, the one with Amy Schumer from earlier in the summer.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, I got you.
Which, if it were really an award for comedy, should win, because that was the most successful comedy, hands down. But it's not really an award for comedy. It's an award for stuff that they had to shove in that category because they didn't have enough room in the drama category. So it'll probably end up going to The Martian, I think. That kind of gives you an idea of sort of the movies I guess people are talking about. I don't know. It's just, there's all these articles out right now. Everyone's trying to figure this out. Like, even Harvey Weinstein wrote an article for The Hollywood Reporter about, like, why this year's award season is such a clusterfuck.
Oh, interesting.
And he's very invested in the award season because that's essentially his bread and butter.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. What do you think about all that?
Honestly, I haven't been paying attention to the award seasons this year. I'm not sure why. Maybe it is because it's such a, there's no like clear like front runners or anything like that. I mean, I guess maybe The Revenant or there's the other one I was thinking of. Well, let's just be honest. It's because Star Wars is happening, so like Hollywood can't think of anything else for the next like bated breath until the next 7 days happens or whatever.
Right.
I'll be really happy when that explodes or whatever. I don't know. I don't have like a real feeling this year. Like most years I'm at least fairly excited. This year I just had no oomph at all to it. Like it was just like, okay. Well, but, I mean, that's kind of the same with the blockbuster season for me this year though too. So I don't know if it's just maybe just kind of a slower year for me in general or what, but
I think it is kind of a middling year. Like when I looked at my current top 10 as I'm updating it, at one point, I changed a little bit, but at one point I was looking, it's like, this is the most eclectic grouping of movies, like, ever. Like, it's, you know, all over the place. But that was, at that point, it was like the end of summer, so I don't know. But, yeah, no, I think it's just a lot that it's all kind of the same size of movie that all kind of came out around the exact same time.
Well, it's gotten so formulaic.
Yeah.
Like, big movies here, insert. Smaller movies here, insert. And there, I don't know, just the more and more that the, like, different sizes of things disappear, the more I just have a hard time, like, looking at it and being like, oh, that one, or this one. I mean, randomly, there's been stuff that's excited me, sure. But I don't know, I just haven't got those feels this year at all.
Right. Actually, a lot of the movies that I've really, really loved are still in, like, the earliest seasons. Like, it was, like, the stuff that came out in, like, February, March.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Well, some of the bigger ones, or the ones that would be higher on my top list, or whatever you want to say.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's been stuff that's in the summer or whatever, but yeah, most of the stuff that I really remember that stuck with me has been around that period. The kind of post Sundance stuff.
Well, they seem to be coming from, I don't know, a little bit more excited, like, or maybe hungry. I'm not really sure, but we'll see.
We'll see.
That's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm like, I don't know how to feel. So,
all right. What was the first news story you had?
So that Catherine Bigelow mm-hmm. talking about somebody. The last thing she made was Zero Dark Thirty, right? And that was, yeah, that was how the last long movie ago?
She made. Mm-hmm. That was 2012, I think, because that was before I moved.
So I mean, that's been like 3 years, mm-hmm. almost four. Well, the first thing that's kind of like popped up with her name in it, which isn't a bad thing. You know, sometimes you need a breathing room or kind of prep to the next thing you want to do. Well, it finally has come out that Catherine Bigelow has been prepping for a jihad recruitment drama through HBO. Apparently, who will pen some of it is the rapper or poet Kenan Warsam. I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
So I will move on and not pretend. But basically, yeah, so I guess they're going to, it doesn't really give much more than they're developing it. But I mean, you can kind of tell from her take on those things, if you're talking about the Hurt Locker or Zero Dark Thirty, mm-hmm. Where she'd go with it. I do actually find, I still kind of think that even though some people argue that we're exiting the golden age, I still think that there's a lot of like TV that can be very interesting because yeah. they're allowing it to be. And the fact that even if she's doing like a 12 episode kind of like miniseries, just how in depth and how you can develop characters is very interesting in that format. So I could see a lot going on with this and being very interesting. Yeah. Also very polarizing, because when Zero Dark Thirty came out, everybody hated her. So
no, it's true. And you know, it's interestingly enough, it's like, she's definitely found her niche in something here, like, you know, doing these stories about our wartime and specifically the war on terror and kind of how it affects the American psyche and the American reputation and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, you look at like all of her work prior to this renaissance or whatever you want to call it of her work, or the second wind in her career. And it was kind of scattered. I mean, she was sort of like an action chick. Like, she was, you know, very much like kind of like James Cameron. Like, you know, at one point they were married. And they use a lot of the same cast and stuff in their early work. And, like, you know, I mean, you know, Strange Days and like, is a lot of, like, genre stuff for the most
Near
part.
Near Dark,
Point Break. Like,
yeah.
You know, nothing people would really call, like, prestige cinema or anything like that, but
well, it's almost her tinkering phase, you know.
Well, that's a long tinkering phase. So I mean, you know, from 86 or 84 or whatever it was to 2008, 2009,
she just, you know, had to wait until, you know, America collapsed, and then she found what she wanted to do her films about.
But she's very good at it. I mean, both Zero Dark Thirty and the Hurt Locker are terrific movies, and I think will stand the test of time as far as if you're talking about movies about this stuff. Because there's been other ones that have kind of fallen through the cracks. Like, for whatever reason, people don't really want to think about it or really want to look at these movies. Or maybe it wasn't approached the right way, or it was too soon or too late in some regards. But for her stuff seems to find that balance really well. So I'm interested in see how it would work long form.
Well, it's always very hard to say anything very truthful about current events.
Right, yeah.
Too much prejudice and bias has come out, and also you're just too fresh on it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that she's able to, and also polarize both sides, which is, I don't know. I kind of, the more and more I look back at Zero Dark Thirty, the more and more I kind of dug what happened with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not necessarily great for the film because both sides were fighting about how horrible it was. But at the same time, both of them missed what it was about. And so I find the way that she's able to construct narratives out of that, they impact me deeply. Mm-hmm. Like, I came out of Zero Dark Thirty being like, this was 10 years of my life. Like,
right.
Like, I get this. I get what this, or I get the feeling. I didn't actually get the movie until like maybe a couple years later. But no, I think I'm excited. And so I think that she understands what she's doing in this genre. So coming out through HBO too, I think is a great format. So it sounds like a winner to me so far.
No, I'm definitely interested. And you know, podcast fans out there will know that if you've listened to the first episode of this season of Serial, which is about the escaped POW Bo Bergdahl from Idaho. You remember that story?
No, not really.
Oh, you never heard about that? Basically, there was this dude who was like a brand new, fresh private in some infantry. I don't know exactly what branch of government it was or branch of military, but he was stationed in Iraq. He felt, for whatever reason, and this is all up to debate, that the people who was ahead of his unit were unprofessional and were putting them in danger. So he went rogue, in quotes, and tried to, like, basically get noticed for getting in trouble so that people would take care of it. And in doing so, got captured for something like 7 years in Iraq.
Well, okay.
And he...
I've heard vague things about this, and I guess maybe I just blocked it out because I was like, oh, I don't want to talk about
that. It's one of those stories. No, it's one of those stories. It's like one of those stories we probably should be hearing more about, but for whatever reason, came and went in the news really fast. It kind of became a political circus because Obama, President Obama, he traded some of the people from Guantanamo to get him back.
That's what I heard about it, mostly. Right.
That's because that's when there was an angle that people could take, which was, you know, it became a big political circus after that. And now there's a bunch of people who are like, you know, instead of like, welcome back, prisoner of war, they're like, you're a traitor and you left your post. And blah, blah, blah. So Serial, which was the podcast sensation of last year about the cold case murder case. This season, they're covering his case, and there's so much question marks around it that they can kind of play the same game of, do we trust this guy's firsthand account? Anyway, anybody who listened to it, going back to the news story that we're covering, Mark Bull, who co-wrote both Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker, is making a movie about this. And is doing all this research, and the Serial people hooked up with Mark Bull's people to get all this information. And now half of the interviews are not from Sarah Koenig, or I think that's her name, who the host of Serial, but most of them are Mark Bull's interview footage. So it's interesting. And both of these people, Kathryn Bigelow and Mark Bull, have kind of, I guess, separated, but they're both very much in the same world.
Well, that's sad. They should get back together and make good stuff. I understand sometimes they're just irreconcilable or whatever.
Right. I don't think it was a difference of whatever. I think they left on good terms. I think it was just like they're both doing separate projects. But it's interesting that they're both doing separate projects that are very much in that wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. Either or, I think the HBO series or Serial, they both sound like they could be very interesting. So,
yeah, and the movie that eventually, I think it's kind of funny. I think like I see both Serial and the Mark Bull movie, like it's kind of cross promotion. Like essentially, Serial is going to be this big lead up to his movie.
You know, I mean, that's not necessarily bad, though. Like, I think that's just a thing they do now. Like, it's just one of those horrible things you have to accept that there's going to be a comic, a video game, a movie, series, a book. Right. And
I wonder if I could backfire on him, though, because like all of the information, all the juicy whatever is going to come out weekly for the next 15 weeks. And how much is there going to be left for a movie?
They might be, but I think they might be like banking on people being still excited about it. But
right, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not really. I don't know if I really understand our modern world very well. Sometimes
I don't know. It's a gamble for sure.
Yeah.
So that was sort of a news story. I didn't even think that I would bring up, but there it is. Okay, so this is the last one. Speaking of Catherine's. Catherine Hardwicke, director of the first Twilight film and the independent film 13. She also did that Twilight ripoff, The Red Riding Hood.
Oh, okay.
She is directing a horror thriller for Broad Green Pictures called Wish Upon. And I guess it follows a 16-year-old girl who finds a magic box that promises to grant her 7 wishes, but with each wish comes dark and gruesome consequences. So it's a fairy tale kind of thing.
Hmm. It also kind of vaguely sounds like Bedazzled. Either right. The 60s one or, the more modern one, the Brendan Fraser thing, so.
Right. I mean, maybe slightly more Grimm's fairy tale version of that, but.
In a way, those kind of were. I mean, yes, they were dumb comedies, but at the same time, ideas get recycled, whether,
Right.
In one place or another, even in horror thrillers, you can sometimes go, oh, that was just really a comedy at one point. They made it scary. So, can we be honest about, Catherine Hardwicke, her stuff kind of has an okay visual, but I've never been necessarily very enthralled by anything she's done. But I've seen 2 of the 3 things you mentioned, so.
Right. It's so hard to really say, because can we really blame the shittiness of Twilight on her? Because I feel like there were other directors who are pretty good directors, like David Slade and Bill Condon, who made Twilight movies that were equally shitty.
Agreed. Yeah.
I feel like there was such a, I don't know, probably.
I guess I was using Snow White as more my example.
You mean Red Riding Hood? Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
Whatever it was. Yeah, no, and that one was definitely, she was cannibalizing her own career at that point. She was trying to, because she wasn't making Twilight movies anymore, she tried to make a Twilight movie without making a Twilight movie.
That's very big of you to, give her the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I mean, 13, I've never seen it. As far as I can tell, it was kind of like, it was an indie, Sundance favorite. It was kind of the same vein as something like a Kids, where it's about like teenagers out of control.
Hmm.
And it was generally well received. She also did the Nativity Story, Christmas movie.
Like with Jesus?
About Jesus and stuff, yeah. But I've heard that it focuses a lot more on Mary. So if you look at her oeuvre, you could see that there's a focus on young women who are in insurmountable circumstances.
Sure.
I'm
all for diversity. I still think the product has to be good. I don't know. That's right. Just my small take, but
yeah, I think the fact that this is going more for a horror angle rather than the romantic gothic thing could make it could give her more license to be more creative, or maybe she wants to shake off the Twilight thing, because that's not as big of a sell anymore. Like, now it's Hunger Games, or now it's 50 Shades, and I feel like maybe this is a clean slate. And
whatever YA sensation that's going to pop up.
Right.
No, I mean, you're right. It could be, because I think it is good to give directors who, just because they've done a couple. If I was in the system, would I direct a Twilight if they backed up a truck to my house and dumped out the money? I'd say, oh, okay.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, it probably wasn't much, because I don't think she wasn't a big name or anything, and they're trying to get it under. I know they're trying to go for a lower budget and everything like that, but it's still money's money.
Right. And it was a big high profile gig.
Right. So I think it's good to give her, but and I guess if I think about, I keep wanting to say Snow White. It was Red Riding Hood, though.
Mm.
If I think about Red Riding Hood, some of the trappings and the mise-en-scene and all that kind of stuff was, it wasn't necessarily poorly done. I mean, it had some dark qualities to it. As a horror thriller, I don't know. I always find that term sort of silly, but,
yeah.
Because I don't know. To me, it's kind of wishy-washy. Well, we'll make a horror thriller. We don't want to call it a horror because it has bad connotations, but.
Well, I guess you could say the difference between a horror with a capital H and a horror thriller is a horror is your saws and your hostels and maybe your the stuff that's more like specifically for that crowd. Whereas a horror thriller means it's maybe a little bit more about suspense and it could draw in a bigger audience.
Well,
probably
I mean,
going to be PG-13.
You hit the nail on the head when you specifically said for a specific audience that they're aiming at a very specific person when they put these like these
those words.
Titles on. I don't think that they mean a whole lot, but yes, I know what you mean.
By the sounds of it, it could also just be part of the like, let's revitalize old fairy tales and you know make them into big blockbusters.
Well, I mean that's been something. I mean, in general, that's something they're still doing and they're still interested in. And I don't know if it's bad, but it's just in general, Hollywood is very focused on the fantasy element of things.
Right.
I mean, I get it because they're able to now, but yeah, I don't know. It could really depend. This has so many variables, it's hard to really predict, but it does give you something to talk about. So.
Right. We'd have to see a trailer before we could really make an opinion.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into our review then for Ron Howard's In the Heart of the Sea. And do you want to set that up?
Yeah, why not? So basically, we start off with Mr. Hemsworth on a farm. Mm-hmm. And he's doing manly stuff on the roof. You know it's true. Right. And basically, you learn that he's not from a hearty stock of family. He has, you know, he's a poor blue collars sort of person, but he's in the whaling trade and he's going to be going off on a big whaling trip here in a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's fairly scarce, but then you kind of see the juxtaposition of the business side and you get to see that he has kind of a rival in the captain, mm-hmm. called George Pollard. And it's sort of about this developing kind of man off between the two, this kind of competition. It kind of talks about the different, it kind of talks about this well oil, which was used to light lanterns and do a lot of things at the time, but it was also very much, you know, killing a lot of animals, and it was a limited resource and one that wasn't always hard to find or wasn't always easy to find. And one that came at a high cost of workers. And so basically you go on this big whaling trip with them and you run into a giant sea monster whale thing.
Right.
It's mostly just a whale. And this is all okay. This is kind of part of it, but barely. It's also being pulled by one of the kids on the boat who's mm-hmm. telling the story to the guy who wrote Moby Dick.
Right,
the conceit, even though it's not like that important to the movie.
Right, there's a framing device. We start with a Brendan Gleeson. He's the aged version of this kid who we meet on the boat. So we're seeing the movie kind of from his perspective,
played by Tom Holland, our next Spider-Man.
Yes, and and he's telling the story to a young Herman Melville who has yet to write Moby Dick. So this is supposedly based upon the text that Moby Dick is based on.
Well, I know this is based on a book. So this is a movie based on a book based on a. Okay, a movie based on a book that's based on a very famous book that was based on the story.
Right. So we're like we're like seven levels inceptioned inside this Moby Dick story.
Exactly, yes.
And Ben Whishaw plays the young Herman Melville.
That was an interesting transition.
Well, I was just making sure. I thought.
No, it's okay.
He has a beard. He looks a little older.
It went there.
Yeah. What did you think of this movie? General impressions.
Kind of a slog. As a general impression. Overall, a beautiful slog. I mean, it looked good. The wells and stuff looked pretty. The boats and the scenes looked good, but I mean, it just didn't. It moved along. The pacing was kind of awkward and kind of just plodded along. And honestly, like half the time, why didn't they just adapt Moby Dick? This is just Moby Dick. Like, right. I mean, even if we're talking about some of like the subtext and stuff like that, where it is talking about the well oil and it's not so It was pretty on the nose. Yeah, it wasn't right. very
the not so subtle nod to
right
to the modern oil conundrum and drilling and that kind of stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and so I mean, Moby Dick already talks about that and the obsession and things like that. So it didn't. I don't know. Most of the time, I was just like, okay, I get this is supposed to be like real, but there's like that weird level of separation because we already have this very famous book. So I don't know. I mean, there were parts that are very laudable. I mm-hmm. thought it was fun when they shoved him down inside the well.
Yeah, that was actually pretty gruesome.
That was very gruesome. but I mean, I know that's sort of like part of it, you know? Yeah. And it kind of tells you a lot about those times. I will say that it felt very true to it, to the time period and stuff like that. It's just, it more, I think the thing that I was mostly just kind of like, about was the pacing.
Yeah, it definitely kind of moves in fits and starts for certain. I don't know. I was, by the end of it, I was surprised how into it I got.
Okay.
Because for the first, like, 25, 30 minutes, I was really struggling to connect for a lot of different reasons. I thought the accents were all over the place. And I didn't know if they were trying to approximate, like, Chris Hemsworth especially, I didn't know if they were trying to approximate, like, a old American accent when there was still sort of a European inflection, or if they were just really struggling to choke down their normal accents. That was a thing. And also, like, I don't know. I kind of wasn't crazy about the look of the movie. It's shot by Anthony Dodd Mantle, who usually does a really good job, and he's a very good cinematographer. But did you see this in 3D or 2D, first of all?
2D.
So did I. And you can tell me if you notice this. There's a weird thing that happens whenever there's a big action sequence, when they're, you know, when the whales are, you know, flipping the boats up, and when there's, or when they enter into a storm or something, whenever they do these close-ups or these handheld shots from like low angles, I thought maybe this was an effect because it was supposed to be in 3D, but it had this really fakey looking green screen effect where I felt like all the characters in the foreground kind of looked like they were like paper cut out and like this obvious kind of green screen going on in the background. But then they would like throw like actual water on the lens and stuff so that it would look like you were in the scene. And it just like, and the only thing I could think of is like, oh, this could be because it's supposed to be in 3D and there's all this depth that I'm not getting.
That could be. I didn't notice that. I guess when I was saying the look of what I liked is those wide sunset shots.
Yeah, no, there's
also the over the head, the wells going underneath the boats, or I thought those were kind of cool.
Yeah, the big sweeping crane shots or like the big helicopter shots and that kind of stuff. Or what I mean, it's probably all just CGI, to be honest, but they're made to look like helicopter shots. That kind of the big establishing shots and stuff, like all the vistas, mm-hmm. that's all really nice. But yeah, I don't know, like some of the action photography I thought was, it felt like almost like a History Channel reenactment.
You know, the thing was, is I, one of the, Ron Howard's last movie, I kept thinking about too while I was watching this.
Actually, thematically, kind of similar.
Well, very similar, except that movie just talked about what it wanted to be about.
Mm-hmm.
Which was the male competition between the two, you know, the two drivers.
Yeah.
Whereas the story between Chris Hemsworth's character in this and the Pollard captain character, it got lost a lot of times. Cause sometimes you're going back to Brendan Gleeson and, young Hamlin Melville played by Ben Whishaw. And sometimes you were going to the weird father, semi-father lost boys kind of tale between Tom Holland and Chris Hemsworth.
Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it was going into all this political subtext or this environmental subtext.
Right.
And all of those themes are competing the whole time.
And then there was Cillian Murphy. He was there.
And then he's there. Yeah. Who is just like, you know, is very good at starving himself on camera.
He shouldn't do that. It's not good.
That's what I'll get into that a little bit. I don't want to spoil stuff, but towards the end, the movie does definitely kind of take a turn for the dark. and it and for a lot more kind of an introspective stare into the abyss kind of thing. And actually, I thought the movie was a little hokey up to that point.
Okay.
I thought there was some nice visuals, and it was definitely a big, you know, period piece kind of thing, and I was sort of enjoying it on a generic level. I actually kind of got more into it as a story and where these characters were emotionally, even though, like I said, the themes are competing. I thought that I actually kind of got into it when it just, like, was getting super bleak.
See, I it lost me. I can't say a specific moment in the movie where I was like more like into it and not into it, because it was kind of, I shifted so much.
Yeah.
The accent thing that you're talking about never really bothered me. I guess I just kind of chalked it up to it being young America, and you've got people coming from where all over.
Right.
I just didn't really want to spend mental effort on that. but I mean, if we're talking about like just attaching to the film, I just never kind of, I mean, I would start to, and then I'd lose it, specifically when it starts to get bleaker and stuff like that. And the scene you're talking about, it quickly cuts to back to your Brendan Gleeson and your young Melville. And I feel like it totally kind of undercuts that scene.
Right. I mean, I agree with you.
I don't know.
You know what it reminded me of? The framing device thing, especially.
Yeah.
I thought a lot about Life of Pi. You remember that?
It reminded me a lot of Life of Pi, not
necessarily in a good way. Right. Every time, like, because the movie's actually pretty good at visual metaphors. There's a scene early on where they're, like you said, carving up this whale. And there's a scene when they're first like stabbing the whale, and it's like spraying the blood, and you see the blood like land on these people, and you really, the blood is on their hands, and da da da. So the movie actually does a really good job at like telling its themes visually. And then we have to cut to Brendan Gleeson and Ben Whishaw so they can spell it out for us. And I remember that exact thing happening a lot in Life of Pi.
Well, when the blood spurts up, too, and it hits them, it's very much like those oil scenes in movies, too. It's very reminiscent.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. no, it did, but I feel like Life of Pi handled it better. And it didn't feel so, I don't know, like just like a Hallmark production or something. Like Brendan Gleeson and Ben Whishaw are great actors.
Yeah, and they give carry really, their scenes. They give really, really good performances. It's just it breaks the tension in such a distracting way.
Yeah, maybe this could be a better movie if it didn't have those scenes in it. I'm not entirely sure because they're there.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, that's just what it does. That's what happens to the effect of the movie, is it just kind of is like, okay, whatever. it takes away from the tension, like you said, and it also just kind of leaves it a little unattached and kind of lackluster.
Yeah. What did you think of the most base elements of it? Because the reason I wanted to see this movie is because I wanted to see Chris Hemsworth fight a whale.
Right.
Could we have used more Chris Hemsworth fighting whales?
Yes, but that's the thing, though, is we could use more of that, but they could have just cut out like a good hour of anything, but you cut out all the subtext, that's the thing.
Yeah, you cut out all the content, just cut to the chase, let's see some more whale.
I probably wouldn't be as harsh either on the subtext if there wasn't a certain denouement on it.
Right.
Attached to the end. That also really left me with a kind of just like, well, this was a lackluster meal. Taste in my mouth.
But it definitely overends. It ends like three times.
It was sort of Hobbitish.
Yeah.
Or Lord of the Rings-ish or whatever you want to say.
Yeah. You have to tie up the journey. Then you have to tie up the aftermath of the political thing. And then you have to tie up the framing device. And I kind of would have been fine with like two less endings.
Well, for sure two less endings, but I really, now that we're talking about it, because honestly, I don't know if I really had a full opinion formed on it.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it was the framing device that really hurt it the most. But it's hard to tell because it's hard to kind of separate it from the movie.
Right. And I definitely think it in general would have been, because it also has to do with just lazy exposition.
Sure.
And it also, it's I don't know, it's kind of hokey, and it's full of like chubby hum moments and all of that kind of stuff. It's
full of what?
Chubby hum moments.
Chubby.
It's a Mark Kermodeism. I think I've maybe mentioned it before. It's whenever you see a movie about somebody famous and then they say the thing they're famous for.
Mm-hmm.
And it refers back to the Karen Carpenter story TV movie when she read her first review in a paper and she said, "Chubby,
Oh. Okay, thank you. I really need to know where this chubby came from.
But yes, there's a lot of those kind of moments where Herman Melville's like, "I will write an epic one day."
Right. All of that was just eye rolling.
Right. Yeah.
And it made me want to see just a fucking Moby Dick movie. I was like, why didn't you just make a Moby Dick movie? It's like the same thing. These stories are almost the same damn thing. But.
No. Yeah. I don't know. But I guess.
You didn't have that problem ever? You were never just like, yep, this is about a big white whale.
I did think about that a lot. I was like, why not? Why go through the trouble? I mean, and I know you're trying to find a new way of telling this because Moby Dick's been done so many times,
sure,
both for television and for the big screen and in literature. But I kind of got over that eventually. I was like, okay, this is what it's going to be. This is what it's going to be. And there are subtle differences. That's why I think I liked that stuff towards the end, even though it's not as action packed. But like I said, I didn't think the action visually was working all that well. So when it got down to just like the bare, you know, survival movie stuff, I actually kind of got into it at that point. I sort of got into the mood of the movie and the atmosphere a little bit more than when it was just kind of doing, you know, the big boat adventure historical epic thing.
See, I'm a weirdo. I think what I attached most to was the Chris Hemsworth and Tom Holland story.
No, I really wanted that to develop more. Even though it's kind of sub Jaws, mm-hmm, I kind of wanted to see.
Oh, I did think about Jaws a lot too.
Right. Yeah.
I forgot about that. There is a lot of Jaws in here, but like the whole idea of
masculinity
way
and all of that stuff. Yeah. I wanted to see how that developed, and I was, you know, I'd set up those, and the movie sets up those thematic pins and never really does anything with them. It kind of goes in two separate ways, and then it sort of dovetails into a political thing, you know, this environmental message, which is halfway interesting, but I kind of felt like the movie went one way and then ended up doing something else.
And again, that's another actor I really like that was in this and did a fine job, Cillian Murphy, but his story just didn't really. He was there.
Yeah. But if you're going to have somebody just be there, why not Cillian Murphy?
Well, it makes me sad because I'm like, you know, he can do stuff. But
so I think we're both a little mixed on In the Heart of the Sea.
Mostly. Well, I would say I'm mostly kind of about it. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. I would say if you were sort of into it, sure, watch it when it comes to your home.
If you're a Moby Dick completist.
Well, not even that. If it just kind of appealed to you because maybe Chris Hemsworth in it. He's not a bad performance in it. If you wanted to see him versus a whale, there's some him versus a whale moments in
that. That was the whole reason I wanted to go.
Well, yeah. You should.
And, you know, some of the whale stuff is nice.
I think some of the whale stuff worked very well. Especially, there was a scene specifically where it was like, it was above head, like the helicopter shot, and there was three boats, and you see the whale swim underneath and the tail and the head and just how big, and you got the scope of it.
Yeah, so, it does a really good job on scale.
There are things that are good about it, and maybe that would disappear on a smaller screen experience. But I don't know. It's just not, it's too lackluster for me to say, like, yes, go to theaters.
Yeah. I also wonder how it works 3D, though.
I don't think that it would really save the day. Because, I mean, your narrative still isn't...
Yeah, narratively, it's still a mess. But
I mean, even if we're saying, like, 3D experience, like something like Avatar. I mean, the story in that was boring, but it was still it didn't have starts and stops. Like, you just got a very, like, very nuts and bolts story that was there in the background. But I mean, the first time you watched it, and if you watched it in 3D, it was a spectacle, and it was a good spectacle. But I don't think that the spectacle would save this.
Yeah, a noble failure.
Sure.
Yeah, and it's certainly not Ron Howard's worst movie. It's certainly far from being his best either. I guess this was something like a passion project, and like took a long time to finally get made. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm like I said, by the end of it, I was surprised how into it I got, and I was more or less satisfied with the overall thing. But I, you know, even you know. 20, whatever it was. Well, I guess more than 20 minutes, an hour plus away from the movie, it's falling apart more and more in my head. So, there it is.
A lackluster feelings for a lackluster movie, yeah.
Okay.
Ready for a very Merry Christmas?
I guess we are. This is directed by Sofia Coppola.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of not a movie per se. This is a Netflix original special.
Holiday special. Yes.
Holiday special. And it's kind of modeled after the celebrity holiday specials of like the 70s, like you know famous people like who does White Christmas? Who sings the song?
lots of people. I want to say Bing Crosby, but
Bing Crosby, yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, you were right. There's the famous one like that he did, and at some point he sings White Christmas with David Bowie. There's also
Did you research this, or do you really know about this stuff?
No, I mean, like, vaguely. You know, you see, like, YouTube clips and stuff, or, like, you've seen them on TV or whatever.
Because I knew the California Raisins. I knew those little claymation things. And yeah, Charlie Brown Christmas. That's about my extent.
Yeah, there was the Rankin Bass ones that everyone knows. But back in the 70s, like when everybody had a variety show,
mm-hmm.
This was the same time when the celebrity kind of D-list or C-list celebrity Christmas specials was kind of a thing too. Of course, the Star Wars Christmas special being kind of infamously
I've seen one that of those one as well.
Yeah, so it's not really a movie, and it doesn't really have a narrative. The basic idea is that Bill Murray has to do a Christmas special. He's filming a Christmas special in a hotel in New York, and he's kind of waiting around to see how it goes. They're hit by a blizzard, and then a storm of celebrities he ends up encountering, some of which are playing themselves, most of which are not. And then every time he sees one, he ends up doing a number. Paul Schaefer, the music director and piano player for the David Letterman show, is kind of there for the most part, accompanying him with piano. He kind of does his like SNL lounge singer bit throughout the whole movie, kind of mixed with a little bit of the ennui of his character from Lost in Translation. I kind of thought this was a mess and not in a, sometimes in a vaguely entertaining way. Like if you step outside of it and you put the whole thing in quotation marks and you're like, I can't believe this got made. And everyone's going to come out unscathed because it's just a Christmas special that was made for free to watch on Netflix. But, I don't know.
I see. I was confused because I did have a feeling that it was modeled after old, like, Christmas specials.
Mm-hmm.
But there's such a detachment because by the time I was old enough, that wasn't really a thing.
No.
And so, I mean, I'm going to chalk it up to your weird YouTube rabbit hole things that you know so much about these. Because, like, I've really not seen any besides the ones I mentioned earlier. But this is, it's sort of very bizarre. When I just kind of let myself just sit there and watch it, it was mostly just Bill Murray singing at me.
Yeah,
And telling vague messages to people from
to random stuff. People. Yeah, it's mercifully short.
What about the Michael Cera little thing? What happened there?
I don't know. What was that about? He's playing, like, yeah, that like gets brought up and completely dropped. Like, you get the idea that this was, who can we get for a few hours and during this? The day.
Okay.
Like a lot of these people were just such walk-ons. And some of the cameos are just bizarre. Like, David Johansen, the lead singer of the New York Dolls, plays a bartender who ends up doing a kind of froggy cover of song.
That Pogue song is like, that's a great song.
Yeah.
They did cut out some of the most naughty bits, though, that are some of my favorite bits, though. So that's sad. But
so he's there.
But that was also, I thought that was a weird, like, little nod to maybe Scrooged. Because even in that little part where he's in the barroom scene and everything like that, they even, like, he refers to himself as the Ghost of Christmas Present and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know, because maybe it was you, but I don't know. I don't feel like it was, but somebody mentioned to me, like, how Netflix, like, they do collect a lot of fucking data on what people watch.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they're just like, okay, we get this person and this person, we do this, and it could be good, and people might want this. Like, I don't know how this came about. Is like, yeah, we should do this.
I think it was just cheap enough,
mm-hmm.
and it was, you know, because it's a holiday theme thing. I mean, it kind of sells itself. Like, it's, you know, there's a few things you can say about this in a larger context that is, I don't know, might help to understand sort of why it happened. Bill Murray has become something of a meme.
Right.
Outside of his career, outside of his movies, even the newer movies he's making, like St. Vincent or Rock the Casbah, these kind of syrupy message movies. He's on the internet, online, he's literally become a meme. And it's, I think, with a lot of millennials or people younger than us even, who I don't even think most of them have seen the majority of his movies, or maybe even any. He's become like a grumpy cat figure where he's just cool to like because he is he. And so I think they're selling a lot of this on that.
You're scaring me. I know memes are like a thing and people like them, but I can't believe that they hold that much credence in this day and age.
There's this Grumpy Cat movie.
I know that Grumpy Cat's a thing. I know people like cat stuff. I just...
You know what? The Oxford Dictionary made an official word this year.
Oh, no.
The laugh till you cry emoticon.
Like emoticon? Like itself?
Yeah, not an actual word. Like a smiley face with a big smile and tears.
So
this,
like,
is the world we live in.
Well, what's funny is that kind of makes sense to me for, like, old people who still have a dictionary. They open it up and they go, aha, and it explains what an emoticon is to them and everything.
Yeah, I mean, the Oxford Dictionary adds goofy words every year. Like, I think, like, tweet was something, like, or twerk or those kind of things. Like,
well, I think they have to kind of, like, oh, look what we put in there.
You know. Just to be in the news ever.
Yeah.
Do you want to mention some of more of these random cameos? Rashida Jones and Jason Schwartzman play a unhappily coupled person that he has to sing to, and then they sing back to him.
Well, I keep wanting to make it make sense. And so you do get a narrative at start. That's why I went straight to Michael Cera when you were talking about these stars, because basically it starts with him being kind of mopey and having the Christmas blues, him trying to get this holiday special. The Chris Rock stuff was funny. I like that.
Yeah, that was probably the best stuff. I mean, if we're talking about what both of those comedians are capable of doing, it's very low on the list of what they should be able to do with pretty much any material. But given that how unfunny and awkward most of this is, it stood out.
Right. But then you just kind of, so you digress into this barroom, people getting married thing, and which I thought, okay, maybe it'll tie back in and we'll get a thing, but then he passes out and it just becomes, am I spoiling it? I don't know if I can spoil this.
No, you're fine.
And it just becomes this big musical number where he kind of rubs up on, it made me feel uncomfortable where he rubbed up on Miley Cyrus a lot.
Yeah, and George Clooney's there inexplicably.
He's very creepy when he pops out of the trees. It's like a very weird blacklight Christmas song.
I will say this, though. Miley Cyrus kind of steals the show, which I don't know what that says about your Christmas special, but, like, her renditions of, I forget which song she sings. She sings a very, very powerful, I think, rendition of Silent Night, actually. And I was kind of impressed by it just on a purely performative level.
Oh, she brought more energy than anybody, that's for sure.
Yeah, and she certainly seemed the most... I mean, I think her stuff was not as recorded live, so I think she had a little bit of studio help, mm-hmm. whereas a lot of this other stuff, like Jenny Lewis's performances, or Maya Rudolph, especially, who's like trying to do this big, like, brassy gospel version of Baby It's Cold Outside, or, Christmas Cold Outside. It's not as good as she thinks she's singing.
Oh, I actually didn't mind her. I was sort of surprised. I mean, mostly because I was expecting, you know, the level of...
You were expecting more of a jokey kind of song performance.
Not just a jokey song, but also kind of like, I mean, Bill Murray is not like the worst I've ever heard, but, you know, he's not necessarily known for his singing ability.
No, like I said, he's...
So
he's,
that's what I was expecting.
He's doing his lounge singer bit.
Well, you know, like, there's a lot of people, like, that act that, like, they try to do the singing thing because they want to get into musicals and stuff like that. So they try real hard, but they never really get that good. And that's kind of what I felt like it was going to be, but I thought she was actually a touch better than that. I thought she was actually did have some range and really belted them out. But, I mean, overall, I was just more confused at what was happening.
Right.
At me.
Her mother was a professional singer. You know that Only You song?
No, I didn't know that. But that's interesting. I do know the song, though.
Only You. That was her mother. Yeah, I don't know. I thought a lot about the Oogie Loves movie. And just like, it's just random happenstance where they just encounter one weird C-list celebrity after another.
Well, I mean, you're not wrong.
I was expecting Cary Elwes dressed as a cowboy singing about bubbles.
Well, okay, narrative wise, that one made more sense. Look wise, this had a little bit more flair. I mean, there were moments where I was like very reminded of a Sofia Coppola movie. I was just very confused because I didn't know what was happening at me.
Well, okay, if we really want to get into it, if we're talking about her, I think she shouldn't do comedy. I mean, this kind of comedy, because you could argue that The Bling Ring or even Lost in Translation is kind of a style of comedy. But I think when it comes to like sketch comedy or stuff that's supposed to have a lot of comedic timing and wit and, you know, quickness.
Well, that energy is not, too.
Yeah, that is not her ballpark. That is not what she was brought to the earth to do.
Well, okay, if we start at the first note where it's like, was this supposed to be about like cheering us up for the holidays? Because it started out really depressed and then got really warm and then he wakes up and he has pancakes.
I guess.
And then he looks out the window. Because I was still just kind of like, man, Christmas times are a bummer. Because that's what this said to me.
All right.
Of course, I just did watch Charlie Brown Christmas not that long ago. And I was like, man, this is a real bummer, too. Never realized.
Well, right. All Charlie Brown, anything is.
Or how Jesus-y that it got. I didn't remember that.
What do you have for us next week for the Netflix homework?
The Way Back, just one way, not many ways, just one way, The Way Back.
Right. Which is like a war film by Peter Weir, kind of went under the radar, a handful of years ago.
Yeah, it's got like Colin Farrell and Ed Harris and...
Big cast, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that'll be exciting. And I'm not sure what we're doing for our main review, but if anyone has anything to say about In the Heart of the Sea, A Very Murray Christmas, if you happen to catch that... or The Way Back, you can email us with your feelings at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us at our Facebook page at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We are reachable and contactable at Twitter as well, at jabberpodcast, all one word. And if you find us there, you know, sometimes I will tweet back and I get pretty bored at work. So...
Well, at least you can admit it.
Right. We're also on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you happen to be there, please leave us a star rating and a one-sentence review. Anything to get people to notice the show a little bit more. We're also searchable under Pocket Cast, Zune, and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Player.fm. And you can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I still have some content available to read over at the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard has a blog, and he at some point in his life may put something else on there.
Actually, I was going to take stuff off. That's sort of similar, right?
It's changing in a way.
Yes.
Over at rdwally.weebly.com. Go check out Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa's work, writings, and as well as a lot of other contributors, as well as myself, over at Brad's new lit webzine called Panel and Frame at medium.com/panel-frame. There's new stuff coming up every day on there, and he's, you know, reaching out to people on Reddit and everything. So there's a lot of different contributors from all over the place writing about all sorts of different topics. Be sure to listen to our other friends who out there who do podcasts, Leland over in Olympia, Washington at dampercast.com. Rod and Denise here in Southern California at The Listening Party, which I did a show on a couple weeks ago for them. And both me and Richard appeared on Patrick and Dennis's Almost Educational, as well as Patrick and his dad over at Make Dad Read Comics. I think that's it. This thing grows every week.
It's kind of like my blog.
Kind of, except for the opposite.
Well, no, it changes every week.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, have a good one. Bye.
Bye.